The first case on the en banc calendar for oral argument today is State v. District Court, Jennifer Plumlee, Real Party in Interest, Matthew Mullen, Real Party in Interest, cases numbered 82236 and 82249. This matter has been scheduled for argument for 60 minutes. I have requested that counsel confer to allot the time appropriate between the petitioner and amici, as well as real parties in interest. Have counsel been able to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Craig, on behalf of Mr. Plumlee and Mr. Mullen, and I spoke with my colleague. I'm going to take the first 10 minutes, and she's going to do the last 20.
Okay. And then I assume, Ms. Westbrook, you have the entire time on behalf of petitioners. Excuse me, on behalf of real parties in interest.
I will take the 20 minutes remaining from Craig Mueller's time on behalf of amici. Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then how about for the state?
Good afternoon, Chief Judge. This is Alexander Chen on behalf of petitioner. I have discussed it with counsel for the legislature. I'm going to take the first 15 minutes. Mr. Powers will take 10 minutes. And then I would ask that I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Everyone watch the clock. We will alert you when those times occur for each side. You ready to begin, Mr. Chen?
I am. May it please the court. I'm actually excited to be here today because, unlike most issues that come before this court, this is one where the state is the petitioner. This matter comes to you from a ruling by former District Court Judge Scotty, who vacated two convictions for no other reason than that the person who was prosecuting the cases was Deputy District Attorney Melanie Scheibel, who also serves as a senator in the Nevada part-time legislature. Now, unlike other matters that may come before this court, the state got to choose to seek relief in filing a petition with this court. It wasn't something that had to take place. And when making this consideration, the state could have treated Judge Scotty's order as a rogue decision by an outgoing district court judge with little precedential value, who's ironically had a case reversed for his own conduct regarding a potential adjournment. But instead, the state decided that this case was too important and that it would be unfair to simply let such an order linger. This case, the ruling by the district court in this case, goes well beyond the defendants that were charged in this case, goes beyond Deputy District Attorney Melanie Scheibel and the District Attorney's Office. Because the outcome of this decision and the ruling could potentially influence hundreds, if not thousands, of cases that are prosecuted, that have been prosecuted, and that may be prosecuted in the future, simply because of the individual who happens to be prosecuting the case. And this level of ambiguity does not benefit any of the parties involved. Victims have a right to have their cases resolved, and the people of the state of Nevada who elect representatives need confidence that those who they choose to represent them are actually able to do so. Therefore, it is the state's hope today that this court will explicitly hold that serving as a deputy district attorney does not violate the separation of powers clause of the Nevada Constitution. I'd like to take a moment to just explain how we got to this point. Deputy District Attorney Scheibel was hired in the District Attorney's Office in 2016 and was promoted as a Deputy District Attorney in 2017. While serving as an employee of the District Attorney's Office, in 2018, she was successfully elected as a senator to the Nevada Legislature. She has served in her capacity as a senator at each of the last two legislative sessions. Now, the facts of the case that bring us here today is actually a separation of powers at work, and an illustration that the separation of powers worked properly in this case. During times that Deputy District Attorney Scheibel is not serving the state of Nevada, she works in her capacity in the District Attorney's Office. And among the cases that she was randomly assigned to prosecute are the ones that bring us here today. Coincidentally, both of the prosecutions involved the charge of driving under the influence. And both cases were brought before a justice of the peace, and in both cases, the justice of the peace thought that it was appropriate to convict both Plumlee and Mullen of the charge, of the actual charge. This was the judicial branch exercising its authority over the decision to prosecute somebody. Now, in Plumlee's case, the conviction was even affirmed by Judge Scotty, and it was not until a motion to reconsider, in which Judge Scotty then threw out the conviction on separation of powers and due process grounds. In Mullen's case, the only issue, or one of the only issues on appeal, had to do with the separation of powers issues. And the although not objected to at the lower court, Judge Scotty also found it prudent to dismiss or to vacate the conviction because of Deputy District Attorney Scheibel's involvement. This court has normally held that failure to object at a lower court proceeding is a waiver for later appellate review. Without any objection, the only way that Judge Scotty would have been able to vacate these convictions, which were not objected to at any stage, would have been to find plain error that affected the substantial rights of these two defendants. But Mullen, Plumlee, and the district court have in no way indicated how any substantial rights were affected. Again, these cases involve driving under the influence. And when it comes to this type of charge, there are certain statutes that obviously come into play.
Mr. Chen, Chen, if I could, I'm sorry, it's Justice Stiglitz. How is an appeal even a proper procedural vehicle to make this challenge?
Well, that is where I'm going to go to next, Justice Stiglitz. You're absolutely correct. If anything, procedurally, I believe a writ quo warranto would have been the appropriate vehicle in which to raise this challenge. And such a challenge was never made. Or such filing was never actually made. But when it comes to this prosecution, what we have here is a district attorney who is guided by the statutes that govern the law of this land, both regarding not only in this case what constitutes driving under the influence, but also NRS 484C.430 provides specific limitations on what a deputy district attorney is able to do with the driving under the influence charge. And by what I mean there is, this is a type of charge where the legislature has determined that unless there's an issue regarding probable cause, proving this case at trial, the case is not to be dealt to something lower just because. So in this case, Deputy District Attorney Scheibel could have simply neglected her duties and have dealt the case lower, even though it's clear that the judges found that there was sufficient evidence to convict them of these charges. So what she did was she exercised proper authority to prosecute this case, and the judicial branch found that the crimes had actually been committed. It was only by virtue of her involvement that the court later even vacated the convictions.
Mr. Chen, if I could interrupt you, this is Justice Herndon. Kind of an easy question to start, but without getting into a debate about state versus local, I'm assuming you would agree that deputy district attorneys are executive branch employees.
I absolutely would, Judge Justice Herndon.
Okay. And you would agree that deputy district attorneys go in court on behalf of the state of Nevada as outlined per statute and enforce the laws of the state, correct?
They do.
In fact, they represent all the time in court that they're representing the state of Nevada. So why are we straining so hard to make something? Well, let me back up. What societal interest do you think is benefited by deputy district attorneys as executive branch employees serving in the legislature versus the very, what I would perceive to be huge amount of distrust the public could feel from their elected legislative representatives also being tasked with enforcing the very laws that they're debating whether to enact?
Justice Herndon, I don't know that the public sees it that way, because at least in Deputy District Attorney Scheibel's case, she was a deputy district attorney at the time that she ran for the legislature, and the legislature chose to elect her. I think because we have a part-time legislature here, individuals such as Deputy District Attorney Scheibel are able to kind of use their knowledge and experience and bring it to the legislative process. So although I understand that she is serving an executive function, I don't believe, because of her position, that she rises to the level of somebody that the separation of powers would actually come into play. And that's because she's merely exercising the statutes that have been passed. She goes to court, a judicial officer, an attorney for the defense, makes sure that everything is proper while in court, and that's the duty and the way that things are happening. So I think that the fact that she happens to be a deputy district attorney also serving in the legislature, if anything, is a benefit, because it's an individual with experience and an individual who understands the systems and the laws that might be passed by the legislature.
Mr. Chin, I'd like to follow up on that question by Judge Herndon a bit. Is there anything in this record at all that identifies the purpose, the intent, even the debate in the Constitutional Convention concerning Article 3, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution?
I believe the record was awfully thin when it comes to everything with regards to the separation of powers arguments that were made.
So am I correct in my understanding that there really is nothing in the record that offers any guidance whatsoever as to the purpose or the intent or the scope based upon Constitutional Convention delegate debates or other underlying data or information that would normally be used to assist in a constitutional provisions interpretation?
I think you would be correct, Justice Hardesty, and along those lines as well, in this particular case, because of the nature in which the challenge to this case came, there was actually very little, if no, evidence in the record regarding Ms. Scheibel's position, period.
So that leads to another question procedurally. We have on occasion asked counsel in cases, why are you here? I understand why you're here, but is this issue the appropriate vehicle to be considered by the court when in Heller we expressly said that issues involving the dual service questions should be considered in a declaratory relief action, not on appeal from a criminal conviction?
Yeah, I would concur with that, Justice Hardesty. I do believe, and I think it's important, as I pointed out in the introduction, that the state is coming, hoping for clarification, because obviously there's some concern about future prosecution.
What concerns me, and I'm hoping Ms. Westbrook will address this as well, the subject of the dual service, Ms. Scheibel, is not a party here today. There's been no development of what service she provides, what functions she provides, whether those functions are in any way in conflict with her service as a legislator. Isn't that the purpose of a declaratory relief action? And I understand the need to have this issue addressed because other judges might decide to go down this road as well. But nevertheless, there is a purpose behind the procedure that was offered up in the comments in Heller.
I concur with that, Justice Hardesty, and would say that on purely procedural and substantive grounds, everything that took place in this case with regards to Judge Scotty vacating the convictions was improper and was an abuse of his discretion to do so, because...
Well, how would you form the disposition based on that that view?
Well,
how would you have this court frame the disposition based on that view?
My understanding is that there is a advisory mandamus, perhaps, when it regards an issue that could really affect, have a widespread impact. And I think that this might be one of those cases that applies to that, Justice Hardesty, because of the concern that to make sure that, you know, our convictions are lawful and that we can stand firm behind all of the things that we're doing. I believe that the law supports our position. However, I think it would be in this case, although procedurally it wasn't exactly correct, I still would hope that perhaps under an advisory mandamus position, this court could get to that ultimate decision.
So what specifically is the issue in the advisory mandamus you're asking this court to address? Is it that this is a issue covered by the separation of powers doctrine in Article 3, Section 1? Or is it a question involving the incompatibility of dual service between a deputy district attorney and a member of the legislature?
Perhaps I think it's a little bit of both, Justice Hardesty. What we have...
Aren't the analysis different?
They might be different, but at the same time, I also think they're similar. And if I could take a moment then to kind of talk about the Constitution and why we have the position that we do. I would say that Article 1, Section 3, the Separation of Powers Clause, it uses certain language that I know that defense counsel has consistently argued that we should just use the plain language of the Constitution. The plain language of the Constitution should prohibit a person with dual service, essentially. But I think that, and I believe my time is coming to an end here for my portion for right now. So I just want to kind of leave you with this, that if we were to look at only the plain language, knowing the concept of separation of powers, and it says that no person should exercise any functions pertaining to another power or another of the departments, I'm sorry, what we get is a literal reading where it basically would be that any person who's ever been tasked with an executive function would never be able to serve in any other department. And I know that that seems absurd, because it is absurd, but it's only through the context that we know of the separation of powers. And it's only through the context of looking at what is a public office, what are the functions that are performed, that we really come to understand that a deputy district attorney should be able to have this dual service. But I see that my time has come.
Mr. Chen, I have a quick question, though. You concede, though, she's in dual service. There's a lot made of, you said at one point she's a part-time legislator, but you'd admit that she's in dual service during the 4 years that she's a legislator.
I would say that she is, I would say that she obviously holds both of those titles, Justice Silver, so we can't deny that. However, I would argue that when she is a legislator, she's performing a purly legislative function.
I know she's on a leave of absence.
Yes.
But she's not separated with PERS as a deputy district attorney when she's up at the legislature, is she?
I'm sorry. I just know that she's on a leave of absence from our office when she's performing her legislative duties. With regards to PERS.
But you're not aware that she separates with the district attorney for PERS purposes. I mean, she's still a deputy district attorney under PERS.
Everything is leave without pay during that time, and I should know because of another deputy who I was responsible for, who also served in the legislature. So I know that they were not accruing anything during the time here because they were not being paid as executive branch employees.
And would you also concede when somebody is under oath as a legislature and they begin their term under oath in that January, they're a legislature, I'm assuming, for the 4 years that she's been elected. It's not part-time. It's the term. It's her 4-year term. She's a full-time legislator.
She And I would agree, Justice Silver, there. Of course, she holds the title. She is Senator Scheibel as well. However, when she's working as a deputy district attorney, it's solely in that function. And when she's serving as a legislature, passing bills, talking with our legislatures, she serves purely legislative function. And at this time...
Who's up next, Mr. Chin?
It would be Mr. Powers. Thank you, Justice Hardesty.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal, on behalf of the legislature. I think the starting point for the court is that the district court got to the merits of the separation of powers issue. It did that, however, by turning the alleged separation of powers violation into a due process violation. But when you have a due process violation, it requires a new trial only if there's a showing of harm or prejudice. The district court did not require either of the defendants in the case to show that the alleged due process violation actually resulted in harm or prejudice. So if the court was looking for a disposition, it would be, without getting to the separation of powers issue, it would be to vacate the district court order and remand for the district court to determine whether the alleged due process violation actually resulted in prejudice or harm. There was no showing below that that was the case. But because the district court did, in fact, get to the merits of the separation of powers issue, if the court doesn't vacate and remand based on that due process issue, then the court needs to address the merits of the separation of powers issue because the district court got to those merits. Turning to the merits, a deputy district attorney, like any other deputy attorney in any branch of government, does not prosecute cases. The district attorney prosecutes cases. The deputy district attorney assists the district attorney in prosecuting those cases. A deputy district attorney never exercises a function of any branch of government when involved in the prosecution because they are not the district attorney. They assist the district attorney. This is the case in every branch of government. The courts, they have staff attorneys who assist the courts in performing their judicial functions, but those staff attorneys are not performing judicial functions themselves. The LCB provides staff attorneys for the legislature to assist the legislature in drafting bills, but those LCB staff attorneys do not perform legislative functions themselves. It is the
Mr. Powers, deputy district attorneys take an oath pursuant to the Nevada revised statutes, and deputy district attorneys also wear badges, unlike staff attorneys.
But deputy district attorneys don't meet all the requirements to be a public officer. Their positions aren't created by constitution or statute. They're created by administrative authority and discretion. They may take an oath and they may carry a badge, but they don't meet the definition of public officer. Those deputy district attorneys don't file financial and disclosure statements under Chapter 281.
But Mr. Powers, let's take a look at the plain language of Article 3, Section 1. Specifically, the phrase, no person charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these departments. Now, Scheibel as a legislator would qualify as a person charged with the exercise of legislative powers. Would you agree with that?
That is correct.
And then it continues. It says, shall exercise any functions appertaining to either of the others, meaning the other two departments, right?
Correct.
So it doesn't say a thing about her being the officer. It says she shall not exercise as a legislator any functions appertaining to either of the other two branches. So your argument is that when she charges a defendant criminally and prosecutes him in the name of the state, she is not exercising a function of the executive branch? She's not executing the criminal laws of the state of Nevada?
Two-part answer. The term functions here means sovereign functions. She would have to be exercising a sovereign function. But when Deputy Scheibel engages in a criminal prosecution, she is not exercising a sovereign function. The district attorney, as the public officer, is exercising the sovereign function. She is assisting the district attorney. She has no individual power under the law herself. She only can exercise the sovereign functions of the district attorney as an assistant, not as a public officer.
And what do you make of the word any in that sentence? Any functions appertaining to either of the others? Now, the three or four states whose law you don't favor in your brief have the exact same language as this, and all of those states are saying, look, this means what it says. Any functions are any functions appertaining to the other two. So if you are a person who's a legislator charged with the exercise of legislative function, you can't exercise any functions appertaining to the others. That's persuasive to me.
It is true that those three other states have interpreted their constitution provisions that way. We believe we have to read the Nevada Constitution in light of the understanding of the framers and the common law. And the framers understood the common law, and at the time of the framing of the Constitution, the common law drew a clear distinction between public officers and public employees, saying that only public officers exercise those sovereign functions and public employees do not. We do not believe that the separation of powers provision was intended by the framers to be a prohibition on dual office holding. It was to be a prohibition of one constitutional officer from one department exercising the sovereign functions of another department, because that's how government exercises its powers, through sovereign functions. It does not exercise its powers through mere public employees.
What do you do with the literal wording of this constitutional provision then, and the way it's structured? How do you deal with any functions appertaining to either of the others?
We believe the term functions means sovereign functions, and that's how the framers understood it. That it's not any function, any literal function, it's any sovereign function. Because again, that common law understanding was part of how the framers drafted the Constitution. They understood the distinction between public officers and public employees. And if you also look at Nevada Constitution Article 4, Section 8, the framers put a prohibition in for legislators. They cannot hold a civil office for profit during their term. If the framers wanted to prohibit them from also holding employment, they could have put that in Article 4, Section 8. They didn't. Why did they leave
that? Right,
but
they do have the except clause in Article 3, Section 1, because what I've been reading to you from continues. It says, except in cases expressly directed or permitted in this Constitution. So they could have had another provision that said deputy district attorneys don't exercise the whole power of the district attorney, therefore they can be in both places. They could have done that, but they didn't.
And again, in Article 4, Section 8, they could have prohibited mere employment, but they didn't. They used civil office of profit because they understood that employees don't exercise sovereign functions. The exception clause in Article 3, Section 1 is definitely intended to certain areas where the legislature exercises judicial powers in impeachment and judicial powers in judging the election returns of those members. So there are times when the different branches of government can exercise core functions on another branch. That's what the exception clause goes to. But we don't believe—
Mr. Powers, I have another question. It appears from the moving papers, from your positions, that if a DA prosecutes, no matter what county they're in, prosecutes a defendant on behalf of the state of Nevada for the crime of fraud, that's non-executive function. But if the attorney general's deputies walk in and they prosecute somebody for fraud, which we have that concurrent jurisdiction with deputies, that is an executive function. Doing the exact same thing, representing the exact same party, the only difference is the agencies. But both sides are deputies. One side's actually engaged in an executive function, but the rest of the state is not, because they happen to be employed by a local government.
Our point is that a district attorney exercises a sovereign function through prosecution, and the attorney general himself exercises a sovereign function through prosecution, but deputy district attorneys and deputy attorney generals, mere employees, are not exercising their sovereign functions. They're assisting the public officers when they exercise their sovereign functions. So deputies are mere employees, and they do not exercise sovereign functions. Only the elected officer does. And just to make clear, an elected district attorney could not be a member of the legislature for two reasons. NRS 281.055 prohibits a person from holding more than one elective office. So a district attorney's elective office, a legislator's elective office, a district attorney cannot hold both positions. In addition, the common law doctrine of incompatibility would prohibit a district attorney from also being a legislator because those two public offices are incompatible under the common law. But when you get to the deputies, they're mere employees. Deputies do not prosecute cases. Deputies assist the district attorney in prosecuting cases. Deputy attorney generals assist the attorney general in prosecuting
cases. Mr. Powers, I apologize for interrupting, but I've heard this and I've read this now several times, this idea of prosecutors being mere employees. Prosecutors have more control and authority over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. That's what Supreme Court Justice and Nuremberg prosecutor Robert Jackson said. The idea that these people are mere employees is, quite frankly, disingenuous. Elected district attorneys, particularly in Clark County or a large jurisdiction, don't go to court. They don't prosecute cases. They don't argue the law. They don't argue sentencing issues before judges. The employees, the deputy district attorneys, do that. How can there not be a conflict with them then seeking to enact laws?
The power to prosecute rests in the elected district attorney. It does not rest in employees. Every constitutional officer in the executive branch, the power rests with them, not with their employees. Every judicial officer in the judicial branch, the power to judge rests with the judge, not the staff attorneys, not the judicial clerks. All of those employees assist the public officer. They do not exercise the power. They represent the public officer, but the public officer is the one who actually exercises the power. That's why there's no threat to separation of powers here, because a mere employee cannot exercise those sovereign functions.
Mr. Powers?
I'm out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chief, may I ask a question?
Yes.
Mr. Powers, does the separation of powers clause even apply to local government?
It's the opinion of this office that it does not, that a district attorney and the deputy district attorneys, they are not considered part of the executive branch when they're prosecuting cases. They're prosecuting cases on behalf of the local government. If they were part of the executive branch, they'd be entitled to the state sovereign immunity in federal court under the 11th Amendment. They are not. The federal courts, based on Nevada law, have determined that the district attorney and deputy district attorneys are not part of the executive branch when the prosecuted cases and therefore not entitled to sovereign immunity under the law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Chief Justice, may I proceed?
Yes, Mr. Mueller.
Thank you, Justice. I'm a trial courtroom attorney. I've had acquaintances with almost all of you professionally at the trial level. On the 26th of July, 1992, you swore me in to defend the state constitution. I actually stood about 10 feet in front of Justice Perry-Gary when he was in municipal court and took the oath. I remember when I took the oath, I was embarrassed because I hadn't read the Nevada Constitution. So I went home and actually read it. And then when I ran for attorney general, I read it again. I didn't think it was fair to go out and ask people to support me if I hadn't actually read the Constitution. The Constitution is clear. The courts have already read the language, shall assume no other duties. That means you can't even play name games. You can't change a title and they still get away with it. There's a complete, utter separation of powers. I was hired as a deputy district attorney. A few months earlier, I'd been guarding nuclear weapons. I got hired as a deputy district attorney, and Rex Bell had me in a police helicopter about a month and a half later, meeting with robbery detectives, deciding on what to do with the case. I could not disagree with my colleague more that a deputy district attorney is not a government executive official. I know that is simply not so. Now, I'm come from the trial perspective on things, so I'm going to just make a couple quick points because I know both many of you have done a lot of criminal trial work. On the 17th of July, I showed up and announced ready in Ms. Plumlee's trial. The state didn't have its witnesses and did not have a subpoena. I moved to dismiss. The dismissal was denied. On the 16th of July, I renewed my motion to dismiss, and the trooper testified I did not get a subpoena. And I renewed my motion to dismiss. It was denied. On the trial date, I renewed for the third time my motion to dismiss. Ms. Scheibel opposed me, and the conviction was held. A trial was held, and a conviction was vested. Over three Bustos or Hill motions that should have been granted as a matter of black letter law. Now, I've done enough jury or enough trials that I kind of know what the answers are going to be before I make motions. I try very hard not to make motions I'm not entitled to relief for. The case should have been dismissed on the 17th of July. It was not. It ended up as a conviction. Now we go to the Molin matter. Molin is rear-ended from behind. Two officers show up, don't even know if he smells a liquor. They don't do the field sobriety test properly. They don't do a chemical test till over 2 hours later. The case should have been a not guilty. Mr. Molin got convicted. Two convictions in a row against the prosecutor who's serving on the Judiciary Committee in the state Senate. Now, I have to turn around and look at those citizens and tell them with a straight face, yeah, the fact that the prosecutor votes on the judge's salary had nothing to do with you getting convicted. Now, there's a reason we have separations of power, and that's exactly why we have it. District Court Scotty got it exactly right, and I'm embarrassed he found the Federalist Paper quote before I did. Federalist Paper 47, the aggregation of power in two branches of the government is by its very nature the definition of tyranny. Now, I'm in the court to protect people.
Mr. Mueller, what about Justice Hardesty's question about declaratory relief? Isn't this, and what Justice Scotty did, the wrong vehicle? This was an appeal from the Justice Court on a DUI conviction, and his remedy is just to reverse a criminal conviction. Why is this proper for us to decide a separation of powers issue?
Well, respectfully, judicial economy, and it is an issue that needs to be resolved. I believe, and I obviously, my political views on the are probably pretty well known to the court, but the reality is many of our citizens are deeply offended by people serving in the legislature and drawing public salaries. I think the issue needs to be resolved. Number one, two, these proceedings were legal nullities. The convictions were had under the Constitution of Nevada. You have to follow the Constitution. I have procedural, and Mr. Molin and Ms. Plumlee have constitutional procedure due process rights. If the government's going to convict him and deprive him of liberty, as Justice Herndon pointed out, the government has to follow the rules. This last legislature.
So, Mr. Mueller, if I could interrupt you, isn't it the case that Prosecutor Scheibel was in the Senate when these charges were brought against Plumlee and Molin?
I was not aware, as a simple statement of fact, I was not aware that Ms. Scheibel was actually serving the legislature in the Plumlee matter. All right. I wasn't aware of that until much later after the fact. The second conviction.
No, but I mean, the fact is, though, as a matter of fact, wasn't she serving in the legislature at the time the Plumlee case and the Molin case were brought? I'm not asking you about your knowledge. I'm asking you about the facts.
Yes, sir. She was serving the legislature when both of the cases were brought.
Okay. With respect to the question that I posed to Mr. Chin, we have said in Heller that when there are issues surrounding an interpretation of the Constitution such as this, it is to be handled by way of declaratory relief. Why wasn't that the proper vehicle on which to raise this issue?
I'm a criminal defense lawyer, functions as a criminal defense lawyer, investing in protecting the citizens, the accused rights under the Nevada Declaration of Rights. This case arose as a criminal proceeding. It is fundamentally a criminal proceeding, and the conviction was not handled in accordance with the state constitution, which makes it a legal nullity. Now, if Mr. Chen wanted to bring a declaratory relief action or somebody else had thought to bring it, that's fine. But respectfully, we backed into this. I'm here at their request to defend the actions of the district court judge. I believe Justice...
Well, it would have been appropriate, it seems, to bring a declaratory relief action challenging Scheibel's dual status before your client ever got convicted in the first place.
Yes, sir, and had I known about that, had I known it before the Plumlee matter that she was serving, I might very well have done that. But
did you know it before the Mullen matter?
No, honestly, I don't recall, sir. I'm not going to try to go back and save my memory. I do not recall.
Okay. Well, again, this is the question is not to insult anybody or offend you, but the problem is that there are. What do you say to the question that I raised earlier? The subject of the dual service is not in front of this court. The deputy district attorney. There were questions asked about whether she's on PERS or not on PERS. We don't know that. There's nothing in the record that offers any guidance with respect to that subject. We don't even know what functions she performs independently of functions that she's directed to perform by the elected district attorney. And there hasn't been any factual efforts developed in this record that I can see that address whether the district attorney himself or herself is a state officer or a local government officer. Aren't all of those matters that should be appropriately developed procedurally in a declaratory relief action? And none of that happened in front of Judge Scotty that I can see.
No, Your Honor. I brought the case as a criminal appeal because the state constitution, and I argued and believe I'm correct in the assertion that these proceedings were in fact nullities. What?
Mr. Powers makes the point that Judge Scotty also found a due process violation. What do you say to his argument that if there was indeed a due process violation, that shouldn't the case be remanded to assess whether or not there was any prejudice associated with the due process violation and develop that? I don't see anything in Judge Scotty's order that even addresses what the prejudice was.
Respectfully, Justice, I deal with the public. Now, the answer is this is against the plain language of every opinion I've received from the Supreme Court has the boilerplate language. Words are to be given their plain and ordinary meaning. And in this instance, shall not assume duties. Now, in this particular legislature, and I don't follow the legislature that closely, but they were up there and did a lot of criminal justice reform. Now, I've got a legislator, 1 week is up in Carson with a special session, and next week she's prosecuting the laws that she's voting on. That violates Article 3, Section 1 on its plain language.
Mr. Mueller?
And respectfully.
Hi.
Yes,
hi,
Justice.
Justice Kadish, how are you today? My question is, Judge Scotty relied for his ruling on this idea that the violation of the separation of powers provision of the Constitution that you're relying on constitutes a due process violation. Do you have some authority to cite to us that would support that conclusion that this violation is a due process violation? Has any other court ever found that?
Well, no, I'm in the same boat as Mr. Chen on that issue. There's very little specific interpretation of the issue. And candidly, it's, you know, frequently the most basic propositions of law have the least support because they never get challenged. And I would advocate to the court that the plain language of the means exactly what it says it means.
Mr. Mueller, I'm sorry, sure. Justice Stiglitz, you mentioned two or three times that it would be a nullity if this was improper for Ms. Scheibel to serve in both positions. There's simply no authority for that position, it would seem, and there's ample authority that under a de facto officer doctrine, even if for purposes of argument you were correct, that wouldn't make the proceedings a nullity or provide the remedy that Judge Scotty provided. So what about that?
I would respectfully disagree. The only difference between a government and a street gang is the rule of law. And the government gets the rule of law because it follows the rules that we've all agreed to.
Okay.
Now, when you don't follow the rules, you don't have the luxury of being a government. You're a street gang. Now, she was brought in. Well, respectfully, and you've asked a very specific question. I'm giving you a very specific answer. We respect government and government power. We have peaceful society because we all agree to follow the rules. The rules apply to everyone. What I'm asking and seeking here, and believe this was granted, is consistent enforcement of the law. Government officials have to follow the Constitution, just like the defendants have to follow the law that the Constitution creates under the legislature.
So what about the what about the de facto officer doctrine? So, for instance, if the judge presiding didn't get sworn in properly and got sworn in late, so wasn't officially a judge, we recognize that everything wouldn't be a nullity that happened. You keep saying nullity. What authority do you have for the remedy that you're requesting?
Respectfully, okay. I don't specifically have one because I could not, like Mr. Chen, find a whole lot of law on this subject. Now, the Constitution gets its plain meaning, and a constitutional provision gets deference because it's presumed that more time and effort was put into it. Now, this is exactly what it means. It means exactly what it says. Now, and your de facto officer argument. There are times and places when well-meaning people get ahead of themselves, they misplace paperwork, the judge's commission hasn't been signed before his first trial. Those are substantively paperwork. That's not this case. This is a case where someone was sworn in to support this Constitution, read it, and then decided it didn't apply to me.
Mr. Mueller, but you're talking about well-meaning people. I mean, since inception, we've had people working, people in state government. The documents that are provided, but this has been happening for over 100 years. We've had people serving in these capacities. Now, we haven't reached the issue, but to suggest that it's only well-meaning people or different, I'm not sure I understand your point.
Justice, this town, the whole city of Henderson is now bigger than the state was when I was a child here. Mm-hmm. The Nevada that I grew up in is long since gone. Now we follow, we're now 3 million people pushing more. We have to be more responsive and more attentive to our laws and our Constitution. This Constitution means exactly what it says it means. And I don't really think the argument, if you want to go, and my colleague wants to go into whether other public employees should serve in the legislature, that's a great issue as well. But my issue is I'm protecting two criminal defendants who did not have the constitutional procedural due processes rights.
But Mr. Mueller, couldn't you have raised that, like on a motion to disqualify Ms. Scheibel or Senator Scheibel?
We have two other cases that probably will never make it up to you, but there's actually two or three more down in court once I've down in front of the justices in Henderson that are exactly in that position. So, yes.
So that is coming up in other formats. I mean, it's troubling to me, further to Justice Stiglitz's point, that for us to take it in this case is, and I understand the advisory mandamus position that the state is asserting, but this wasn't raised in Plumlee until a rehearing in front of the district court. Isn't that right?
Yes, Judge. I brought it. I put it on for rehearing as soon as I learned that Ms. Scheibel was served in the legislature. And I've been.
And then the other case, it was not raised. It was raised at what point in the other case, Molnar? It was on appeal from the Justice Court conviction, correct?
Yes, and if I do recall, the record is getting pretty voluminous. I did object, and I did object timely on the Molnar matter, as I recall.
So we would have to say that this renders the proceeding an entire nullity because of the disqualification under separation of powers to credit your argument in either of these two cases. I mean, that's what Scotty had to have done.
Yes, Judge. I would advocate to the court to remand this to the district court and the lower court with instructions to vacate and seal these records. These proceedings were nullities. They were not had under your state constitution.
What about convictions that are closed and completed? Would this apply to that too, in your view?
That's a tougher question, Justice. I'm glad you got me on that one. I guess it would turn on the magnitude of the knowing and voluntary. Ms. Scheibel is a young prosecutor. She only was in the office at this time 2.5 years or 3 years. Don't know that we really have to respectfully go back and worry about vacating a lot of convictions. But if you had felony convictions, boy, that's a tough question. It's not the one that's been presented by my case, so I if You want to ask Ms. Westbrook?
I'm afield. That's fine. I don't mean to cut into Ms. Westbrook's time either. Thank you.
So, may it please the court, justices, my name is Deborah Westbrook, and I'm appearing today as counsel of record for three amici, Clark County Public Defender's Office, Clark County Special Public Defender's Office, and the Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice. And I'm here today supporting real parties in interest Jennifer Plumlee and Matthew Molin in their argument that Nevada's separation of powers clause barred Senator Scheibel from prosecuting them for violations of state law. There's one thing that the parties agree on. We all want the court to address the separation of powers issue on the merits, and we all agree that the issue is appropriate for advisory mandamus. The parties' disagreements mainly center around the framing of the issues in this case. But the place to start with is with the plain language of Article 3, Section 1, because that's where we can find the purpose of the text and the scope. The plain language of Article 3, Section 1 prohibits persons charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of the three departments of state government from exercising any functions appertaining to either of the others. As a state senator, Melanie Scheibel was charged with the exercise of legislative power. All the parties agree. So the question this court needs to answer is whether Senator Scheibel's prosecution of the real parties in interest was a function that appertained to the state's executive department. If so, the prosecutions were unlawful. But LCB and the state would like this court to answer a different question, whether legislators can hold positions of public employment with the state executive branch or with local governments under Article 3, Section 1. But as Justice Hardesty pointed out, the dual employment issue is not properly before this court. Heller said that there were two proper ways to raise a separation of powers challenge to dual service. That would be in a quo warranto action by the AG to challenge an executive officer, or a declaratory judgment action to challenge executive employees. And I agree, this case is neither. We are not challenging Senator Scheibel's employment or her ability to work for the Clark County District Attorney's Office in some capacity. We are challenging specific actions that she took during her four-year state Senate term, and the nature of those actions should be the court's focus. So how do we determine that prosecution is a function that appertains to the state's executive department? You ask, is the function reserved to the state's executive department in the Constitution? If it is, then the function is a state executive function. So we first look at Article 5. Article 5, Section 7 says, he shall see that the laws are faithfully executed. And this court has interpreted that language to mean that the executive power extends to the carrying out and enforcing of the laws enacted by the legislature. In Del Papa versus Stephan, this court held that when the three justices of the Nevada Supreme Court initiated an investigation into potentially criminal behavior, that was a function that was reserved exclusively for the executive branch. Those justices were not members of two branches of government. They were only members of one branch. So the question was whether the action that they undertook, that function, whether that function related and was exclusive to the executive. And that's why this court held that those functions were a nullity.
Ms. Westbrook,
yes,
Justice Kadish, my question then is, what about the In re contested election of Mallory case from 2012, where our court held that the district attorney is not a state office but a county office, and therefore is not part of the state executive branch but part of the county executive branch?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the court held that a county district attorney is not part of the state's executive branch. What the court actually held in that case, and again, the court wasn't interpreting Article 3, Section 1. Article 3, Section 1 doesn't contain the term officer. So whether you know, Article 3, Section 1 isn't limited and only applying to people who are officers in more than one branch. What the court said in Mallory was that term limitations provision in the Constitution did not apply to county district attorneys because those county district attorneys were not state officers. But again, that analysis isn't really relevant to the question of whether prosecution is a state executive function.
Well, Ms. Westbrook,
it might be.
What about
Actually, it might be, Ms. Westbrook. What about this court's decision in 1893 in Sawyer versus Dooley, where this court said it is the state government as created by the Constitution, which is divided into departments. These departments are each charged by other parts of the Constitution with certain duties and functions. And it is to these that the separation of powers clause refers. Didn't we make clear in that case that this clause refers to the state departments, not local governments?
So I think the distinction is in the nature of the so separation of powers involves there's an individual aspect of it, and then there is a departmental aspect of it. So the in the context of the departmental aspect, no branch of government should be exercising functions that belong to a different branch.
Excuse me, I'm sorry for interrupting, but I think Justice Pickering went through an interesting exercise of asking everybody to look at the plain language of the article that we're talking about. I assume you would agree, as amici, that there really isn't any reference or usual source that courts look to, like Constitutional Convention delegate comments or notes, or other historical information surrounding the adoption of this provision when it was entered into our Constitution in 1864. So looking at the plain language of this, it refers to departments. That's a part of the language, isn't it? What departments is it talking about?
So it's talking about persons that are charged with the exercise of power belonging to one of the departments. So clearly a legislator is a person, that person does belong to that department, but it prohibits them from exercising functions that appertain to the others. So the question is whether prosecution is a function that appertains to the state executive department. And I would say that it certainly does. If you look at the Article 6, Section 13, it is in the judicial section, but it says the style of all process shall be the state of Nevada, and all prosecutions shall be conducted in the name and by the authority of the same. In our very Constitution, the concept of prosecution is a state, it's a state function. So I don't know that it matters who is the employer of Senator Scheibel. What matters is, who is she acting on behalf of? The client is the state of Nevada. She represents the state of Nevada. The attorney general has authority to intervene in any case that a deputy district attorney or district attorney is handling at all levels. They can supervise, the case. They can, also supervise the office. The attorney general is also involved at the appellate stage. So this is clearly, regardless of whether that power is being exercised by a county employee, it is still a state power, and it's recognized as such in our Constitution.
Well, and I think, Ms. Westbrook, that's kind of what this court said in 1998 in Scholes, in Justice Shearing's concurring opinion, when she said the judiciary cannot interfere with a county prosecutor's death penalty decision-making authority, that there's a separation of powers issue. It wasn't that they're local, so the judges are free to kind of weigh in on that. It was purely a separation of powers violation, correct?
That's correct. And I would also point to the Justice Pickering's recent opinion in Rigetti, where the court held that it would be a separation of powers violation for a district court to accept a non-conforming guilty plea over the county prosecutor's objection. And in that case, the court said that the state had almost exclusive right to decide how to charge a criminal defendant. Rigetti was prosecuted by county district attorneys. So if Article 5 gives the state, through deputy district attorneys, an almost exclusive right to decide how to charge a criminal defendant, and if Article 3, Section 1 precludes the judicial branch from interfering with that right, then deputy DAs have to be engaging in state executive functions when they prosecute criminal defendants in the name of the state. In State X Rel Harvey, the court made a very interesting statement there. Language giving the legislature authority over certain county offices was created solely as a mechanism for permitting the counties to perform certain executive functions, such as the prosecution of criminal actions, through a county officer rather than a state officer. So that means that Article 4, Section 32 simply allows the legislature to assign the state prosecutorial function to county officers. Prosecution doesn't stop being a state executive function at the moment it's assigned.
Ms. Westbrook, I apologize. You would disagree then with the conclusion of then Attorney General Sandoval in 2004 when he concluded in that opinion that, in fact, the local district attorney's office was county and not part of the state and thus not prohibited by the separation of powers provision of the Constitution.
I would absolutely disagree with that. I mean, we know prosecution is a state function. Not only is it listed in the Constitution in Article 6, Section 13 as being in the name of the state, we have NRS 169055. A criminal action is prosecuted in the name of the state of Nevada as plaintiff. The state was the plaintiff here in justice court. The state was the respondent in district court, and the state is the petitioner here. The laws that were violated by Plumlee and Molin were state laws. They weren't county ordinances. So, you know, this is clearly an exercise of state authority. As to the court's prior question,
Ms. Westbrook, just for purposes of argument, if this court agreed with you, how would the client be entitled to the remedy that the client was provided?
I was just about to talk about remedy. So in non-criminal cases, the court has said previously that it will declare a government action invalid if it violates the Constitution. And the court has done that in cases where taxes were deemed to be, improper. I think the Baxt case is an example of that. But I think the better way to analyze this case would be structural error. Because structural error is an error affecting the framework of trial. It's intrinsically harmful. In Baral is an example of a case where, you know, there was a statute that was violated that had to do with the swearing in of jurors. And the court said that it was a due process violation that affected the framework of trial. So I think the court can find this to be structural error. Well, and the reason I believe it's structural error is because a separation of powers violation of this nature is intrinsically harmful. In Galloway, the court said, the division of powers is probably the most important single principle of government declaring and guaranteeing the liberties of the people. And James Madison, quoting Montesquieu, when the legislative and executive powers are united in the same person or body, there can be no liberty. Allowing a state legislator to prosecute violations of state law is exactly what Article 3, Section 1 was designed to prevent. It's intrinsically harmful because, as Justice Herndon pointed out, it undermines confidence in our government and our criminal justice system. But structural error, I will say, doesn't...
Ms. Westbrook, if I could interrupt you on that point. If the court were to agree that this is to be reviewed as a structural error, then it would seem that the answer by to Justice Pickering's earlier question to Mr. Mueller about prior cases should all be reversed in instances in which a member of the district attorney's office is also serving as a legislator. Is that your position?
No, that is absolutely not my position, because we know structural error does not mean that every case Senator Scheibel and Kenes are all prosecuted will come back. Under Jeremias, this court has said structural errors can be forfeited. You have to show prejudice. You have to show that the error affected a defendant's substantial rights. And if you go to Weaver, Weaver discussed there's three types of structural error. There's, you know, the type that always results in fundamental unfairness, such as the, you know, denial of the right to counsel or the failure to give a reasonable doubt instruction.
So shouldn't these two cases be remanded for the same type of analysis?
I would agree that I think the cases should be remanded for that type of analysis. I don't know that this is going to open up a finding that Senator Scheibel and Cannizzaro can no longer prosecute is not going to open the floodgates for a whole bunch of these cases to come back.
I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt your answer there. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, for cases that haven't yet gone to trial, essentially what would happen is, you know, the court could dismiss, or I'm sorry, the DA's office could dismiss the indictments and informations and recharge with a new prosecutor. For cases that were on direct appeal, if there was not a prior objection, certainly defense counsel can raise a constitutional challenge at any time, as Craig Mueller did in these cases. But Jeremias would require a showing that the error affected the defendant's substantial rights. And a similar situation would occur with post-conviction relief cases.
As the court debates the case and conferences on it, we frequently think about intended and unintended consequences. you argued, and either you or Mr. Mueller, I can't remember which, argued, maybe both of you, that this issue only applies to prosecutors. It does not apply to public defenders. There wasn't any authority cited for the division, but why wouldn't it apply to public defenders?
Well, there's a
Are public defenders covered by this section of the Constitution?
Public defenders are not covered by this section of the Constitution. I said the question, I guess the question again would have to be, what function does a public defender perform that this court would contend is reserved exclusively to the state executive branch of government? And the court has already
Some would argue that it's the state's responsibility to provide indigent defense, not the county's.
So regardless of whose responsibility, and actually, I believe if you look at in 1963, when the Supreme Court ruled in Gideon that states must provide indigent defense to the clients they must provide attorneys to represent indigent defendants. That was something that came out, again, 100 years after our Constitution was ratified. It was not a concept that our framers were initially contemplating. It was something that was recognized as being important under the federal government's Sixth Amendment, but it wasn't, it's a different kind of function. We know that executive functions, at least for purposes of our Constitution, involve carrying out and enforcing the laws enacted by the legislature. And we know that includes prosecution and law enforcement, but public defenders do not prosecute and we do not enforce the law. We're responsible for personally defending individuals who have been charged by the state with crimes. We don't represent the state. The state of Nevada is an adverse party to us in our litigation, and our entire obligation is to our individual clients. So if the function at issue is criminal defense, if that's how we're going to frame, if we're going to ask, is criminal defense a state executive function, I don't think anyone would say that that's reserved to the state executive branch of government, because the state executive branch couldn't lawfully defend a criminal defendant. There would be a conflict of interest. That's why we have to be separate. So,
well, the state public defender's office reports to the governor under our current structure, but we're getting far afield. Thank you for your arguments, Ms. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chin, you have 3 minutes and 29 seconds.
No.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, your time had expired. All right, we ran over. I'll let you take 3 minutes to make your rebuttal. I think you're muted, Mr. Chin.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty, and I don't anticipate using all 3 minutes because I do believe it's been heavily covered. But I would like to specifically cover two things that I heard throughout the argument after I had previously spoke. It's with regards to something that Justice Pickering said as well as Justice Herndon. And I believe both justices relied upon the plain language and indicated the plain language says that the no person shall exercise a function. And I believe Justice Herndon also kind of spoke of the powers of a prosecutor and that we were referring to prosecutors as mere employees. I think that in this particular case, though, what I want to say is that mere employees is a term of art. It's not that we're saying they're mere or that they don't exercise some type of executive power and function, because clearly we agree that a prosecutor does. But I think what the difference is the fact that the deputy is under the power of the sovereign, and that is the actual district attorney, not the individual. And what I would also point out is that these actions quo warranto, this court in Matthews versus Murray spoke about the action quo warranto, and it's only to usurp someone of a public office, not of an employee. So that's where this language of mere employee versus public office comes from. And that's why it's our position that you have to apply that standard. If quo warranto is the proper procedural mechanism for this type of case, you have to, if an employee is not a public officer and it doesn't apply to them, then clearly the Constitution isn't referring to a deputy district attorney. It's only referring to an actual public office. And that's the exact holding in Matthews versus Murray. So with that, I still think that this is an important matter for the court, but I think that you have to go beyond, and I hope this court goes beyond the plain language, because as Mr. Powers pointed out, and as the history shows, there's much more that went into the Constitution than just the simple language alone. And so for that, I'll submit it.
Mr. Chin, do you concur with what Ms. Westbrook said a moment ago, that your office, as well as on her side, very much want a decision on the merits of the separation of powers issue?
I think it is important, Justice Herndon, and I know that it was covered by the other justices as well about what does it mean if this court comes out with a decision, because obviously there will be consequences to whatever decision the court makes. And those considerations could be far-reaching. So for that, I think it's important because we all want to know that we're doing the right thing, Justice.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for your excellent arguments today, and we appreciate your briefing in the case as well. And the matter will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until...